So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm Nate Larkin.
I'm David Hampton.
And we've got a great conversation coming up with a wonderful guest.
Yeah.
You and I, I'm so glad, you know, that our visits are not confined to this hour behind the mic, but you and I also get together on a weekly basis just to process life together.
Yeah, which I love.
I do too. I just got to tell you, it's special to me to be able to do that with you.
Well, I appreciate that, Nate, and likewise, many levels.
Yeah, so. Yeah. As I told you yesterday over coffee, as kind of an experimental thing, I stopped drinking alcohol on the 1st of January.
Right.
I made a 21-day commitment.
Uh-huh.
I'm quick to say that I'm not an alcoholic because I have breaks, although I have noticed over the years that I tend to hit the breaks a little later and later.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Still, you wouldn't classify me as, I don't think, a heavy drink. Maybe, perhaps, on some scales.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you, David, I'm really disappointed by how much better I feel.
Oh, yeah, that part, right.
Yeah. I really am.
Yeah. It's funny how the brain gets to recover and the body gets to adjust some sugars and some things like that, and all the toxins begin to kind of wash out, we can feel pretty decent.
Yeah, now I'm also eating cleaner, and I've started going to the gym every day. So I'm telling myself that that's the difference, that really the alcohol is inconsequential.
Yep.
But in the back of my mind, I know that story isn't entirely true.
Well, yeah, it's it's that combination of things. And what's interesting too is, the concept of alcoholic, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have people that are probably really just heavy drinkers,
mm-hmm.
who may actually drink more than my people who would identify as alcoholic.
Yeah, yeah.
But the alcoholic has, you know, consequences and unwanted consequences, and
mm-hmm.
they repeat the consequences,
right,
and
right,
there's,
right.
you know, so on and so forth. I mean, we can go down through all the list of stuff. But it's just interesting that if we took, you know, the amount someone drinks as the criteria, that's sometimes a very deceptive barometer to use, but...
You know, I'm rereading with Allie, my wife, this week, Annie Grace's book, This Naked Mind.
Mm-hmm.
You just read it a chapter at a time. And she makes the pretty provocative case early in the book that we've placed the blame in the wrong, we've put the blame in the wrong place.
Mm.
We've blamed the drinker, not the drink.
Right.
And that's allowed us to say that some people are alcoholic kind of by nature, genetically, or by virtue of an allergy, something physical,
mm-hmm.
And they can never drink safely. And there are other people who are not alcoholics who can always drink safely and never have to be concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
Where she will argue that alcohol is actually an addictive substance, which, although you can't predict the rate at which somebody might, their tolerances might grow to the point where they become dependent, she would say that most everybody's vulnerable.
Right. Yeah.
And that my strategy of saying, hey, I'm a sex addict, I'm not an alcoholic. So
mm-hmm.
there's no need for me to be at all concerned about how many beers I'm having a day, or whether I skip a day, how regular my alcohol consumption is,
mm-hmm.
because I'm not an alcoholic. That's dangerous ground.
Right. We tell people all the time, you know, we have to keep in mind that your brain doesn't know the difference between a shot of whiskey, an orgasm, and a chocolate cake. You know?
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe I've been a heavy drinker.
So, you know, I don't know how much cake you're eating.
No, I will say that my alcohol consumption has improved as my sex addiction has gone into abeyance. Right?
Yeah. No. But yeah, it's a brain thing. And she's right in that we have our culture has gotten very good at wanting to think in terms of labels, whether right. I fit into, am I exactly that?
Right.
You know, people will come to me in my office and say, you need to tell me whether I'm this or I'm this.
Right.
And I'm like, well, that's not how this works really. But, but yeah, I am glad that you feel better. And I'm glad that you're, you know, I think it's just always good for all of us to look at what we're doing and why we're doing it,
yeah.
regardless of where we fall on a spectrum or on a continuum.
Right.
You know, I'm not a New Year's resolution person. We talked a little bit about that, you know, last
yeah.
week, but, my thing is, I adopt a couple of words a year, and my words this year are integrated and intentional. And if I can ask myself when I'm dealing with something, am I being intentional
yeah.
about that? You know, and am I integrating my life under one umbrella where this one integrated person can live, so mm-hmm. to speak? You know, intentionality. You know, I was dealing with some financial stuff recently, and I thought, am I being intentional about that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was going to the store and I was looking for food, and I'm trying not to have junky food around. I mean, being intentional about that.
Yeah.
You know, what behavior am I willing to change in order to get my different result?
Yeah.
You know, all that. But I'm glad you're feeling better because you're very positive anyway. But I've noticed you being just a little perkier.
And I feel more energetic. I gotta tell you, I keep remarking to Allie, gosh, I feel better.
Yeah. I'm very happy about that.
Yeah. Well, and you're going to be really happy about this conversation. You're well aware of who has popped into town this week and has agreed to appear on the podcast. Mm-hmm. We'll let our guests know in just a second. We'll let our audience know in just a second when we come back mm-hmm. on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. We are back in the Positive Sobriety Podcast here with an old and dear friend.
Absolutely.
Oh, man.
The high priest of the Samson Society.
He is. Dave Bunker was present at the very first meeting.
Yes.
And as I say in Samson of the Pirate Monks, very much made the meeting. And
he
I
did.
Think in my book, made the Samson Society so crucial to its development in those early years. A guy who's much beloved in these parts, even though he hasn't lived here for quite a while. Poet, philosopher, sage, spiritual director, marketing guru. Yeah. And
average or below husband. I didn't want my wife listening to this going like, what the heck?
We're not going to call
Who's
in
that for... dude? I don't know who he is.
And professor at the Visible Music College in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes.
Yes.
Dave Bunker. Welcome, Dave.
Welcome.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you're with us. What we'd like our listeners to get to know our guests a little bit on a personal level, so we always ask a personal question in the front end, a little bit of story. You, like David and me, you have a Christian upbringing, correct?
Yes.
Adopted, right?
Adopted.
Yeah, so, and yet by mid to late teenage years, you were headed 90 miles an hour toward the hippie world. Is this true? Or?
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, tell us, thumbnail it for me.
Pastor's kid, born out of wedlock in the 50s, never knew my father, adopted into a very religious home, almost cultish in the sense that it was a doctrine and a lifestyle that was very separatist.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of the holiness culture, which there's tons of good things about that movement and that mm-hmm. culture. But growing up was you know, was instilled in me that life was dangerous and very risky, and that I was bad until I was perfect. Of course, that perfection, once puberty hit, I was just like, excuse me? Who changed I can't do this. But nobody's talking about that because in some ways that was part of the shadow of that culture, which was you don't talk about what you can't integrate, and so you're in denial about it.
Yeah.
So by the time I was 14 or 15, and I was adopted, so my DNA and genetic inclination were not the same as my dad or my mom's. I was an artist, and I loved, you know, I had a penchant for Bacchanalia. You know, I mean, it was just like, but once I heard rock and roll, and I got in bands and would sneak out on weekends. And and so by the time I was 18 and a friend of mine said, hey, there's this festival in New York. You want to like hitchhike? And I'm like, yeah, let's go. So all of a sudden, there I am, you know, climbing over a wall like a fence at Woodstock. And I had no idea that this would be the entrance in some ways to a lot of beauty, a lot of truth, a lot of hedonism, a lot of brokenness. And so I did come back into my spiritual life at some point in my late 20s, but I spent a lot of time estranged and critical of my upbringing and didn't know how to integrate it.
And went deep into the world of rock and roll. In fact, one of the redemptive parts of the story is years later you would teach a course on the history of rock and roll at Wheaton College, right?
And I'm on one of the boards at Liberty University in the music community. It's like God's sense of irony and humor. I have to just go, this is...
Is that on the Comedy Channel in hell? Or something? Are you like those meetings? Can I tune in or get you at that meeting?
Well, you can come with me to the next time we get together to the board meeting. You know what? The good things about my life and... that I've learned to love people and offer the gifts that I can. But, it did set me up for, in some ways, as the conservative evangelical subculture tried to integrate modernism, if you will, and the changes. I was a little ahead of the curve where I could kind of explain it missionally to them. It's like, well, I think what they're saying is, and all of a sudden there was the Jesus movement.
All right.
And the rock and roll and festivals and Cornerstone Festival and this and that and this and that. And I moved right into having my own record label and ended up kind of taking what I'd loved and learned and seeing it, well, for want of a better term, redeemed.
Yeah. Wow. Do you see yourself today in the young men and women who show up at the Visible Music College in Memphis?
Oh, big time. Because telling your dad that you want to be a musician or a songwriter, it'd be better to say, I want to work at Dairy Queen for the rest of my life. It's like, what?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I want to write songs. I want to be in a band. What? And like, most parents would like to say, well, you know, my experience when I was in a band. So it's kind of like, I think my kid is... on the wrong track, but he really loves this and he seems to want it, so what should we do? And then I end up being the guy like telling the parents like, oh no, I think your kid's right. I think he's really talented and probably won't make a lot of money, but he'll be one fulfilled dude.
So
I see myself in those kids a lot.
Are they pursuing music to feed the Christian subculture, or are they pursuing mainstream type of things, or a little of both? Or
I would say it's probably more 70% mainstream and 30% Christian. There are some kids that want to go into worship leading, but there are kids that just want to do dance remixes and play clubs and stuff like that. So it is what I would call a vocational, so mainstream music meeting larger markets rather than just the Christian market are involved.
I am these days being very heavily impacted emotionally and intellectually by Russell Brand's book, Recovery. And by the way, listeners, I highly recommend it. But get the audio version so you can hear Russell himself preach. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Russell makes the case, quite persuasively, I think, that pretty much everybody is somewhere on the addictive scale. that we find something to distract ourselves with, medicate with, dissociate with, really that it's a function of modern culture. And so everybody would benefit from a focused recovery effort within community, with connection. Mm-hmm. Is that something that rings true with you, David? And if so, in what ways?
Well, it rings true in my own experience with my own, what I would call, desire. Mm-hmm. And I tend to see desire as a good thing. And growing up in a culture that saw desire as a bad thing, it was kind of like, well, if I have this feeling and I want this thing, there must be something wrong.
Yeah.
Now I begin to realize, well, if I want something, what is it that I really want? And is my want good?
Yeah.
Is there something askew in my want? Mm-hmm. And I assume that for a lot of things that I want, there's always an element of like, you know, give me as much pizza as I can have. Give me as much beer as I can have. You know, so there I am, satiated with beer and pizza. Mm-hmm. Can't even get out. So, okay, so moderation. What's moderation? But I think what Russell Brand is alluding to is that we live in a culture where so much of the commercialism of the self, if you will, is like, buy this, go here, buy this, you need more, you need more, you need more, more channels, more phones, more this. And so when it comes to desire and it comes to closeness and belonging, unfortunately, that energy gets sexualized because we like looking at beautiful people.
Yeah,
we like
yeah.
looking at attractive people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But at what point is that attraction actually not an accurate representation of what humanity is really about? And I think that the individuation, if you will, like the isolation of people from community has allowed the business narrative to just come in and just run roughshod over mm-hmm. us mm-hmm. to a point where we're just going from purchasing experience to purchasing experience. And sexuality tends to be one of the most powerful ones because it's so a part of our deep animality, if you will. In mm-hmm. other words, there's a part of us that wants to procreate. There's a part of us that mm-hmm. wants to be, you know, close and intimate with people. You know, this will sound really strange, but every once in a while I love to watch when they find stray dog videos.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see this really mean dog that, you know, is trying to protect itself. And within an hour, this dog is rolling over on its stomach and rubbing mm-hmm. its stomach and petting it and mm-hmm. giving it a bath and stuff like that. And you realize, here's this dog who has been a stray dog who's longing for community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And someone say, what's your point? It's just like, I feel like I'm that stray sometimes going, does anybody want to hug me?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but unfortunately in the culture, it's more like, does anybody find me sexually attractive? That's not really what my heart is saying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, but not most of the time.
Right, and we know that addiction is rooted in isolation, most of it, mm-hmm. and it's a connection disorder. We have all kinds of ways of saying that. But it's not until people realize that they even are alone, I think, that they can realize that they're in trouble, because I don't even think we're as aware of our loneliness.
There facsimiles of community that are fooling us?
Unpack that.
The illusion of being known? Or
yeah,
something?
Yeah. Social networks, mm-hmm. prime example. Well, I've got nearly 5,000 close personal friends.
How can I be lonely?
How can I be lonely?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was at a meeting before I came over here this morning. I was telling you guys a little bit about it. I was watching or listening to people talk, and this is my judgment, and it's skewed with my own personal prejudices and so on and so forth. But I felt like everybody was talking like a social net. You know, it's kind of like what the expected jargon and mm-hmm. what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And no, except one guy, and he said, I'm a little confused. And I thought, wow, a little vulnerability here. He's confused. And I was thinking, dude, I am really confused because I want to chime in, but I'm not really sure if jumping to the story at this point is efficacious or makes any sense, because I'm not sure what we're talking about.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I know we're angry and upset, but mm-hmm. is there something deeper in this?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I think that the deeper thing was I'm a little threatened about who I belong to.
Mm-hmm.
And what my future is going to look like. And so I need some boundaries, and that's good, but wow. And so now the social media becomes this false matrix.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like political sayings back and forth.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. We speak in memes.
Yeah, and lob things over the fence at one another from our respective subcultures that we identify with, maybe.
And yet even that can become highly addictive. So mm-hmm. I've got to always be checking my Facebook, my Twitter, my Instagram. Am I getting likes? Am I getting seen? Mm-hmm. Am I eliciting a response?
Am I still okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a book, I cannot think of the author. Have you heard the book, The Devil in Blue Suede Shoes? It's a book about advertising, subculture, and faith. And the guy in the book makes the point, I may have this a little confused, but he makes the point, advertising today is not about what's right about the product, it's about what's wrong with the consumer. So, in other words, you know, back when, you know, I was a kid, we had three channels on TV, a product that wanted to hit a particular demographic knew that between 2 and 5 in the afternoon on these three channels, we would aim all our money at women who stayed home, detergent. And this sock is whiter than this sock, and that's mm-hmm. how we're appealing to you. And if, you know, you want to have white socks, this is the white sock. The whiter sock. Now we appeal. It's almost there's almost nothing about the product at all. It's about, you know, are you even a good mom or dad? Are you a caring parent, or are you this guy? I don't even care about the product. I just want to be that guy.
Well, here's the scary thing in the world of big data. The advertisers know so much about us. I mean. Reams. They know where we go. They know what we like. They know what we buy. That data is being collected every minute, every day. Mm-hmm. It's like that mean older brother, and I'm the oldest in my family, so I'm putting myself in that role, who knows your weakness, and he knows just what button to push to get you to move. Okay, well, yeah. We're getting all kinds of negative. So this is the Positive Sobriety Podcast. So let's talk about contentment. How do we back away from this culture of programmed and deliberate dissatisfaction, this relentless message that you're not right until you do this, or you need more, or what? How do we, Dave... What's the way back toward contentment? What's life look like out of this insane rat race?
Well, following my own journey, I think one is finding a group of people that are willing to let you unpack your story. Because I still don't know my story totally. It's I'm living it, so it's unraveling, if you will, when I tell it.
Yeah.
But it's also changing daily because new things happen and experiences happen. And I find it with the I wonder if it's Bill Romanowski that wrote Devil in Blue Suede Shoes. But the idea that this narrative is intrusively going into what we might call our perceived desires. Mm-hmm. And yet, if we don't have a community that goes into our deepest desires, what are our deepest desires?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Those are spiritual, philosophical, existential, for sure. In other words, you have to decide, well, what does life mean to me? And I don't think I understood until I got into a recovery group that my longing was pretty common. The other guys... and gals had it, and that it was based on my experience, but it was also based on how I was wired as a human being, that there were certain questions that I needed to answer, and those questions were not about what kind of car I was going to buy.
Right.
The questions, and this is why I love Richard Rohr when he talks about the common wonderful, and I sometimes when I talk to young kids, and I'm realizing my 20s, kids in the 20s now that I, with college, you tell them, it's like, you know you're going to die.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll just get this look like, what the frick? Why are you saying that? That's just maudlin and sick. And I'm like, it's a little hard to hear, but it's true. Mm-hmm. And so in light of that story, all that to say, I learned a grand narrative in my recovery group. Mm-hmm. I mean, a bigger story that included you, included me. And I didn't have that before. I had a very isolated, fragmented everything all over the place. And I'm not suggesting that that is easy to find by any means, but I'm suggesting that when you start answering your deeper, deeper questions, you love better, you cry more, you're more open to affection. And in other words, my humanity is wrapped up in these stories. And when I'm free to tell them and explore them, I mean, I've seen guys tell their story for the first time, and you watch on their face that they meet themselves in the story.
And I think there are different ways to tell the story. I have a good friend who you know, part of his exercise that he does with folks is he says, hey, tell me your story in 10 minutes, but tell me your story with you as the villain. And then later on, he'll say, you know, I want you to tell me your story again, but now tell me your story with you as the victim. And then a while later, he'll say, I want to hear your story again, but this time tell me your story with you as the hero. And it's amazing how the story changes by how we see ourselves. Now, I think that we need loving feedback from others in order to see ourselves correctly. I needed early in recovery, really, I needed to see myself as something other than the victim. I then made myself the villain, which is part of owning my shadow. I mean, I need to accept responsibility for the harmful things I've done in my life, and that's part of step work, is to make a list of those who've harmed and become willing to make amends to them all, and then to go ahead and make those amends. But that doesn't mean that I am, in my core, a bad guy. And if I buy into this story where I'm a villain, which some theological systems would encourage, that really impacts my story and the rest of my life.
I have people coming in all the time who, especially from certain faith systems, and they have this idea that there's good me and bad me, and recovery is to get more pennies in the good me jar than the bad me jar, and I'll be better. So I'm here for you to help me behave in a better way. And we talk about the fact that, you know, there is really just you, and let's integrate all of this so that we can all live under one umbrella as opposed to the segmented, fragmented, that was bad me or I relapsed and bad me took over, or the devil, or, you know, whatever construct we want to assign to it. And so, yeah, the whole integrating of a human self, it, to me, is key in recovery. And you can't do that unless you know yourself and know your story. And we do tons of work with storying and getting people to come to grips with, you know, I'm the sum of a bunch of stuff. And not all of it is just summed up so neatly as, you know, I'm liked when I'm sober, and I'm good when I'm sober, and I'm bad when I'm not. And integrating is huge.
You know, I think we talked earlier a little bit about, just before the podcast here, the role of art and story. And ironically, I believe we're in a renaissance of storytelling and artists. In a lot of it's been because the internet has allowed for so many people to pop up. Now, some people would disagree with that, because if you look at mass marketing, some of the most stupid stories are the most pervasive. But if you look underneath and you get a little bit more discerning and look, there are some beautiful, beautiful conversations taking place. I don't know if you're familiar with Krista Tippett and On Being.
Oh, yeah. Love that.
But we're starting to see conversations take place with people, diversity conversations where there's great difference, political conversations where there's great disparity, artistic perspectives where people are saying, here's how I see it. And I'm realizing that part of telling my story is also balanced with listening.
Yes.
Really listening to the other. the other in quotes, and regarding them almost as part of the divine saying to me, I'd like to reveal myself to you, but if you're going to think you get to bypass the other that's in relationship to you, won't happen.
Yeah.
Because you're going to find the deepest, most spiritual things in listening. And so I find that I've become kind of a pedestrian aesthetic mystic in my later years, where art and beauty, sometimes I just will let it speak to me. And it says many different things to me. I mean, if you've ever gone through the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, God is on acid. I'm persuaded. It's like, what the heck?
Yeah.
This is the wacky, and it's underwater, and nobody gets to see it but other fish, and they're supposedly colorblind.
Yeah,
I'm like, now, when you start realizing how much quirky beauty there is, you know, because now we're in a time where everybody's like, here's the ugliness of that culture. Here's the ugliness of that story. And I'm almost to a point where part of my recovery is avoid the ugly. You know, stay with beauty as much as you can. You know, so porn to me is a beautiful story that's bastardized because it's offered to me on a plate. Rather than when you see a good movie where a couple decides that they want to be amorous and they want to love each other, it's integrated.
Right.
It's hard to lust because you feel like you're a voyeur rather than you just jumped out of the story. And so my recovery was like, okay, I can't be involved I can't allow myself to get lost in a fragmented story.
Yeah.
I need to stay in the grand story. And the grand story is full of beauty.
Wow.
Yeah.
Look for the beauty. It's another perspective question. What am I choosing to focus on? What am I picking out of the scene?
Even, quite frankly, with people that you disagree with politically.
Yes.
It is amazing to me now, and I have to practice it, but like when somebody's, you and I have talked a little bit about this, where you're watching somebody and you're going, man, they're afraid. I know that. And then they'll say that they're afraid because they'll tell me a political reason. I'm thinking, I don't think that's it. There must be something else.
Yeah.
And so I'll listen, and all of a sudden, you know, I'll realize, huh, I think they're afraid the same reason I am, which is like they don't want to get ripped off, and they don't want to be taken advantage of, and they're going to make sure that they build that wall. And I'm like, oh, I have a lot of that in me too. And all of a sudden, all of that difference gets ameliorated into the grander story. And I allow myself to take that narrative that this is a little, discouraging to me. And sometimes I disagree with it totally. And it melts.
Yeah.
And my commonality with that person just emerges. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting there going like, well, here's two of us really confused, but we love life. Isn't it great? Here, you want a beer? Let's have a beer. Let's do it. And all of a sudden, and I'll hear people go, it's like, I'm so glad that you agree with me.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, actually, I don't agree with you on about 80% of that political stuff. But I do agree with you that we get lonely and we need each other. And I'm willing to be here for you and you're willing to be here for me. And I love you, dude. Let's have another beer.
That must be the key to your remarkable, I don't know how to put it, David. I look in awe at the way you are able to be a gracious presence in all kinds of situations and in all kinds of atmospheres, religious, philosophical, political. The people that don't talk to each other all talk to Dave.
Right.
Huh?
Right, yeah, yeah.
And you're a good lover of people, brother. You really are. I aspire to more of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is going to sound strange. What I'm going to say is part of the listening, too, is learning to allow myself to weep over beauty and beauty and sadness and stuff. And the older I get, the more when I see a friend who's struggling, even if I don't have their answer, there's that intercessory part of my humanity that goes, oh, I wish I could help you. I don't really know what to say to you, but I'll be here with you. And I'll share with you this experience, which is we're both going like, do we really belong here? Does this make any sense? And on some days I'm like, yep, I belong. It's beautiful. And on other days I'm like, get me the freak out of this place. This is the most crazy wackadoodle universe.
Yeah.
If there is a God, he's cruel and unjust. And so it isn't this straight line. Like when I say pedestrian mystic, I use pedestrian because there are some days when it's just like, you don't seem too mystical to me. This is my wife saying, you know, I don't think so. Because I realized that the price that sometimes I have to pay to get the lens of seeing the beauty in others is I have to die somewhat to how I want to see this and open myself up to that listening part. And it's amazing how, just like birds, you know, you hear, I don't know if you've ever done this where you go out and you'll hear a bird on, and you'll mimic it.
Yeah.
And then they'll do it back to it. And I find humans are the same way. It's just like they'll say something. And so I'm listening, to your point, I'm listening for something that I can wholeheartedly agree on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when it happens, I'm like, I totally relate to you. Mm-hmm. And they get this endorphin rush, and I get the endorphin rush.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, they may go for 2 more hours, and I'm like going, don't agree with any of that. You know, but there's enough disagreement, and most of the problems, too, that divide us are actually deeply philosophical problems that are not easy to solve.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, yes, yes.
Oh, that they were easy. Oh, that the human condition, here, take a pill.
Yeah,
you know, but we have to have therapists and counselors in recovery, because it's a slow journey.
Yeah, yeah. And I see this decision to focus on what we agree on, to focus on beauty, to pick that out, as key to staying sober. Mm-hmm. If I'm just going to focus on what's ugly or what I disagree with or what is wrong, I am amping the pain all the time, and I'm going to need to do something to medicate or distract myself or somehow ameliorate that pain.
Mm-hmm. Well, and beauty is, and creativity is all part of what stimulates the prefrontal cortex, where our executive functions are. So it's a physiological thing as much as anything, and we know the more the prefrontal cortex goes, I say this all the time, but the more it works and the more it's active, and the more engaged and creative and integrated it is, the quieter the limbic system in the back of the brain is, the amygdala, the fight or flight, you know. When it tells you there's a bear, you listen and run like hell, because that's it, it's doing its job and you should listen. But when the limbic system is telling you there is a bear and there's no bear, then we're in anxiety.
Right, you know.
And the way to bring that back into a functional order is with beauty, creativity up here in the prefrontal cortex of the brain. And we always tell people, find that thing where you find joy. We call it a neurology of joy. Find the thing where you find joy, where you find beauty, where you can engage and know and be known and love and be loved. And that's what groups are. You know, it's not always an AA group. It's a group where you feel known. And, you know, if it's a, you know, your watercolor group. I mean, that is great for the brain, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're starting, and I've done it before, art nights. Actually, Dave Carlson started art nights up in Chicago. And you get a gathering, and you might bring a poem. Doesn't have to be your poem. It can be somebody else's poem, a movie, a song, or whatever, and you share it. And it can. And we go down as low as 12 years old.
Mm.
So it is amazing when somebody says, let me share you the new song on a Paul Simon record.
Yeah.
And they'll put it on, and everybody just listens together. And what I love to do is watch the person who brought the gift.
Mm.
And that's it for me. It's just like, what gift do you bring to the room, dude? Mm-hmm. Bring your gift. And if we would concretize that exchange more, then, you know, it'd be like, hey, here's Rex is coming. What is Rex bring? Last night I'm watching, you know, him do a Sting cover tune, and I wanted to send it to all my friends and just say, I have a friend who kicking can do Sting, and you don't go, well, that sucked. Because you know, if you're going to do Sting and you suck, it's just like, oh, dude, you shouldn't have done that. That's just not right. So I want to become a proponent of like here's this guy's gift. Here's this woman's gift. Let's proclaim them. And if we saw each other through the gift and then operated out of our gifts more, because I love our group, you know, people say with your men's group, how is it? I said, I have enough men in my life that can tell me it's just like, you know, it's like Robert De Niro in the movie. It's just like, was I kind of stupid tonight? It's just like, just a little bit. Just a little bit. You know, yeah. Like, you've got friends in your life who will go, you're a little out of your beauty zone right now. You know,
yeah.
You know, you're still part of the community, but you're out of the beauty zone.
Yeah, let's focus just a little bit more on that word beauty, or maybe expand it a bit to art. But let's talk about beauty. If I'm going to, as a recovering addict, now, it could be that in order to feed the beast, I've become an expert at getting upset. If I'm not upset, I'll find a way to create anger or anxiety, and then I'll use. Mm-hmm. I'm just not adept at looking at something that's actually going to feed my soul. Mm-hmm. I don't instinctively look for beauty. Mm-hmm. Dave, I'm venturing back out into the world anew. I'm starting life over. I'm going to go in search of beauty. What are the things I can do to look for beauty?
Well, one thing I would say is pay attention to what makes you laugh and cry.
Mm. Mm.
And the great thing about art, and I've had this happen with your music, in our church affiliation together, where it would be a Sunday and it would be time for liturgy and the music would be playing, and your choices were just so good. And I would find that I would be like, my taxes and, my mother-in-law. And all of a sudden the music would happen. And I'd be like, like, whoa, it just took me right there. You know? And if what I watch, especially with men, is like spend a week paying attention to what moves your soul deeply and then repeat it.
Okay.
Do it again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you'll find that in your week, just like little, and somebody says, well, how do you know that? It's just like, watch your little kid. Mm-hmm. What does your little kid do? I mean, all of a sudden, have you ever watched like a little 4-3-year-old when some song comes on the radio and they start doing a jig?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, well, maybe you should do a jig with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do a jig. You know, lose your self-consciousness. So pay attention to what moves your soul to beauty. And then have spiritual practices where you repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, it's like that, just like you get addicted to something that's not good for you, you start to get addicted in some ways to something that's good for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you long for it. And I didn't start out with the ability to be alone like more than maybe 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And now I can do it for a couple days.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if somebody said, so are you just peaceful? It's like, oh, no, the first one third, it's just like I got Star Wars in my head, you know, and I have to quell it. Mm-hmm. But I'm willing to wait through that. Listen to the noise. Look for the beauty. Do the spiritual practice. Do it over and again. And what happens now is that my soul starts to it's like a sweet tooth for beauty. It's like, do more of that. But identify it. And for a lot of people, isn't it interesting? They know what makes them angry. They just don't know what makes them laugh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Wow. Dave, you work with a lot of young people. How do you see, the people in the 20, early 20s zone? What are their, a lot of the ideas about addiction and culture and things like that are changing or shifting. You know, people are, I find in younger clients, they're maybe even less prone to believe in something that is, quote, addiction. That almost seems to them like an old paradigm. They can believe in powerlessness over something or that they're struggling with something, but also they live in a culture that's so I don't want to say permissive because that sounds, like I'm talking about legalism. I'm not, but they are not in a culture where there's very much in the off limits zone where you can get in trouble. We feel like we're really in control at that age. Do you feel like there's a move toward understanding the need for recovery at some of these younger adult ages? Maybe this, I don't know, maybe that's the wrong question.
No, but I like that question a lot. I like that. You're catching what you're saying, aren't you, Dave? Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think that I see a lot of aha. And some of it's because how could they?
Right, life experience.
And some of that is that we've lost our elders. We don't have elders.
Okay.
They've
yeah.
left the room.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
When I meet somebody my age who's bitching and complaining about people under 20 or mm-hmm. under 30, I just want to go, dude, then don't be around them, but yeah. stop being their judge like when you were mm-hmm. in your 20s. So I tend to tell my kids at the right time, it's like, in your 20s, you're horny and stupid. So be careful how many mm-hmm. big decisions you make, because you will be living with them for a long time.
Yeah.
But then I also say, we share, it's like, what does it look like to be in a safe family?
Mm.
And in a safe family, you have a shared ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And that ethic is articulated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what a lot of the millennials lack is, because there's such a relativity on the ethic, that you get a room where everybody is like, well, this is what I want, and this is what I want. Well, what I've tried to do is do what I would call a symbolic analogy. And there's a lot of the students come and say, well, I write music, and I don't really want to partner with anybody. I don't want to co-write.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not a discouraging person, so I don't want to go, well, I hate to tell you, but your song sucks, so you might as well be a plumber, because you're not going to be a songwriter. That ain't going to happen. I listen. And one time I spoke to the entire student body, and it was risky. And that's another thing, too. The older I get, the more I go, like, look, be a fool for what's beautiful and true, and don't give a rip about, you mm-hmm. know, the fact that you look old, you have gray hair, and you have a fat ass, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just go for it. I said, let's jam. And like, let's co-write. So I got a couple guys who would start it out, you know, and so some bass player, and immediately, you know, I said, join in when you hear something. You know, one of the students was like, it was all just in their mouth, or if they had it, something, they beat on it. And within about 15 minutes, man, we had a groove going, a melody going.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, now we're going to go to the chorus. Now we're going to go to the bridge, and so on and so forth. And I said, now that's an example where you shared a musical ethic.
Mm.
And the ethic was, listen, when it's good, follow it.
Mm-hmm.
When it's bad, introduce something better.
Mm.
And I just find that the kids, they're looking for metaphors that make their story make sense. And we tend to offer, I think, at times, a criticalness about the human condition that they're mm-hmm. in. Mm-hmm. Almost like it bothers us, mm-hmm. forgetting that we were there too.
Yeah.
Rather than go like, these desires are all good, but without some kind of ethical embodied, what's like crucible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a crucible. It's not confinement. It's more, how do you hold it?
Mm-hmm.
And is it good? And they need more beauty. And then I make the analogy, well, that's the way it is with touch and feelings and what you want from other people and what you request from other people and what you expect from other people. And in a really loving community of belonging, we're clear about what we want.
Mm-hmm.
We're clear about what we expect. And then people can go, I can't give that to you. Or I don't feel comfortable giving that to you. And this is where we're in a culture now where it's like almost everyone has a tendency to want to victimize somebody else. It's
right,
just
right.
We're in this really strange place. And so I'm encouraging my kids anyway to embody your ethic through your touch, through your life.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make it some kind of a strange belief religious system. Make it the way. So when I encounter some woman that I find highly attractive, I think about her life and her children
yeah.
and her husband and her dad and her mom and the times they've spent for Christmas and all these other narratives. And I think, you need to sit down and shut up, bozo. I'm talking to myself, because that energy is so not part of the narrative that was going to make her life enhanced.
Mm.
What's the narrative that you can bring? And sometimes, like, I don't know, I'll have to sit and watch. But I can enjoy her beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I can say, my beautiful eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But my feeling that I have the right to want to own that or control that or mm-hmm. victimize that. And that's the thing that I've learned, too, that everybody that I would see in porn has a story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'm connected to that story.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot, what's the word, dehumanize them in private and not have it spill into my public life. It doesn't work that way. I don't I don't get to be have a private ethic. I have a, that's what I would say, is that my ethic is how I engage the moment with people. And if it's not a healthy one for me, it's probably not a healthy one for other people.
Yeah. Wow.
And I love the way that that ethic is modeled and structured and practiced and repeated in healthy recovery groups.
Yeah, you have to, that was the beauty of finding people that would tell the truth. It was, to me, that was what a recovery.
Can I stop you for a second?
Yeah.
That's a line for a song. This is what I tell my kids, you know, I tell them to when they're paying attention. When you find somebody who will tell the truth. Isn't that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, that's a great line.
Well, if you end up with that, just, you know, you heard it here, I just 10%.
Yeah.
That's all I need.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I don't want publishing. Just give me 10% of the writing. I'll be fine. But
how about a shout out on the album cover?
That's right. Can you tell we've been in the music business?
Yeah, exactly.
I walked through the room while you were writing it. Can you give me 10%? Yeah, but it is. It was going in these rooms and somebody actually telling me the truth, and they weren't consumed with really maintaining. I mean, I'm talking about the people that had been there a while. They weren't concerned with so much what I thought of them, because that wasn't why they were sharing.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it was almost this cathartic confession that I got to be privy to, and but they were telling me the truth about themselves, about their nature to create chaos so they had an excuse to engage in behavior they wanted to engage in. But they couldn't really just go out and do it. They needed to be pissed off at somebody first so they could justify it, you know? And I hadn't ever heard anybody say that in a context that I'd been in before.
Yeah.
So anyway.
That reminds me of a Samson meeting where... you know, we'd go through the times of confession, and there's an elderly gentleman, probably a little older than me, and he shared his story, but I could tell, and I was projecting, I could be wrong, that we kind of cleaned it up for the group, and as you know, like, so I said, well, I want to confess that I'm, you know, a murderer and a sodomite. And I mean, I listed these things and I could watch his eyes just look at me like, are you all those things? I don't know if I want to be in the same room as you. And I was kind of like, it was a teaching moment. I was kind of going like, look, dude, just jump into the deep end of the pool and don't worry about what it's like, you know, and that's what's great about too recovery community, that it's almost like nothing is out of bounds, unless of course it was illegal. But
yeah,
you know, and boy, the sweetness of that reception.
Yeah.
What a gift.
Yeah.
When all of a sudden nobody bats an eye, and at the end they put their arm around you.
Yeah. Isn't that gorgeous?
Oh, you're like, yes, I want more of that.
Yeah. Well, we all want empathetic witnesses to our pain. To, you know, to say, we hear you.
Isn't it interesting, empathy? When you think about it, I don't know how that affects the brain, but man, do we lack it in our culture.
Oh, man, gosh, that's a... Well, yeah, because it costs something to care, you know? If I'm gonna care about you and extend empathy and really look at your story, I've got to give up a prejudice or a preconceived idea that I have about you or about your thing or
I've got to give up my relentless preoccupation with myself.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Right. Because it falls on you. It's what am I going to do with that? If I extend an empathetic witness to something, because caring is going to be more than me going, wow, hope that comes out okay. hope you get over that okay.
But isn't it soul feeding? And didn't we experience this ourselves in recovery? That it was like the second stage of a rocket kicked in, when we, having received empathy from others, we began to extend empathy toward the newcomer and began to go out of our way to help somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And taking that positive step for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, speaking to that, I'm going to be a little vague here because part of the what we do in New Adam and even in Samson Society, you don't talk about people's stuff. I remember a weekend when a guy was processing and the pain of him sharing a story was so powerful that he went to on his face on the mat.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't cry. All he did was... One of the guys who was there working with him got down on the floor 2 inches from him and started going,
yeah.
It was a sacred moment. It was so powerful. I could not believe because I didn't, you know, he was saying, I don't know what you're saying, but I'm gonna do it with you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, it's one of the most powerful, you know, what I call rug work, where I watched a guy get processed. And I think about empathy right now, and this is what grieves me. When we watch a mother who is carrying a baby and she's afraid that somebody's going to hurt the baby, and, you know, whether it's gas from something or whatever, you know. And I don't want to politicize that issue, but I will know this, that if you've had a child that's been raped, murdered, hurt, you are going to have empathy at a profound level. And not all of us are going to experience those things. But there are times where if somebody said, what do you think Christians should be doing? I said, I think weekly they should just go out in someplace in public and just weep.
Mm-hmm.
Weep for the suffering that's taking place in our world. Because that suffering is often why people seek out other things, you know, because they're like, I don't want to feel this anymore. And so I find that my empathy is like, well, can I embrace my own suffering?
Yeah.
And not blame myself, but just embrace it, feel it. And that's what I've learned from you guys, is that this is a safe place to break down.
Yeah.
This is a safe place to cry. We're not going to tell you to stop. We're not going to tell you. I love it when I've seen weekends where somebody cries for about 20 minutes and this person who is with them says, are you through? And they go, no. They cry some more. And in your case, David, where you're a therapist, it's just like, this is a lot of kind of expensive to come and just cry. But you know what? That's the gift.
Yeah.
That ability to go, I'm fragile. That hurt. Would somebody comfort me and protect me? And if we can identify that, then all of a sudden we're like, why would I want to hurt anybody else?
Yeah.
Why would I want to, you know, transfer this hurt to my children?
Yeah. Yeah.
And but that's a vulnerability we don't get an opportunity to go to very often.
And sometimes crying is the most positive thing I can do. It's the most positive step I can take.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Laughing it off isn't going to solve anything.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's even a study, I can't remember where it was done, but another therapist was telling me about this, that the chemical compound in your tears, actually, there are toxins in tears. And when you cry and these tears just stream, that part of that endorphin rush, so to speak, of just weeping is a release of toxins. You know, there's a physiology to grief.
Boy, that's a subject we need to explore further. David, do you think we can find ourselves a grief expert, a crying expert? I'm looking at my watch, and I'm just absolutely astonished that time has flown so quickly.
Mm.
As always seems to happen when I'm with Bunker. An easy man to spend time with. David, thank you for spending time with us and our listeners on the podcast. God bless you and your work out there in Memphis. Glad you're here. for a short time in Nashville. It brightens my day every time I see your face.
Well, I'm looking forward to being in Memphis at the Rabbit Hole.
Oh, yeah, let's mention that. I'm going to be doing a Rabbit Hole evening. We call it a lecture series. I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, lecture series.
Yeah, yeah, in Memphis, the first weekend in March. Where am I going to be?
Christ City Church.
Okay.
In Memphis, and it's it's a really good lecture series where you can come and spend 2 hours just dumping conundrums.
Yeah.
that'd be a great name for like a small group, dumping conundrum.
Or a rock band.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, kind of like an Irish, metal. Dumping conundrum.
The dumping conundrum.
Even the name, you could put a beat to it.
We talk about the poetic thing because you brought up another one, toxic tears.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's Rex's assignment. He's going to have to put the band together, the Dumpin' Conundrums, to create our new theme music. Well, again, Dave, thank you so much for joining us. Listeners, hang on. We'll be back for a closing word here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And Nate, anytime I'm with Dave, I always feel like I wish I had another hour.
Yeah.
Because I love his view on culture and on integrating. We were talking earlier a little bit about integrated living and just how we think about ourselves as empathetic people, lovers of beauty, all that.
I love being around Dave because he lives what he talks. Mm-hmm. He's got a very curious mind.
Mm-hmm.
Really open. He's looking for beauty all the time, and he'll look most anywhere. Mm-hmm. Whether it's in books or whether it's in people.
Right.
And he finds it no matter where he is.
Yeah, yeah, he does. And he encourages us to look beyond ourselves and into that world around us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my great sadnesses right now, a little regret, is that I know Dave is a fantastic poet.
Yeah, he is.
He posts his stuff occasionally on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
and very often I'll share it or I'll download it. But he's not yet published, which to me it seems tragic.
Yeah, I would love to see his work.
And we didn't ask. He doesn't maintain a personal website. He's not building a platform. He's not a self-promoting guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I would encourage any of our listeners who were especially taken by Dave and would like to get to know him a little better or move more into that orbit.
Mm-hmm.
He is on Facebook. Look him up, Dave Bunker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy to follow. You will learn a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, before we sign off, let's remind our listeners that we would love to hear from them.
Mm-hmm.
Can't promise that we will always read a letter on air, but we will respond. Send us a note if you'd like to. At positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, absolutely. We love hearing how these things impact people.
Yeah. And we'll be back next week with another stimulating conversation with another fascinating guest.
Absolutely.
Until then, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
And we are your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelly, music by Rex Schnelly, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.